Welcome to Talking Books on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series I discuss books and what they mean to my guests on the programme. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today Rosemary Caruana. Just a few words about my guest. She gained a first-class degree in English back in 1979, and then took what might be described as a career break, work and full-time mother, and then, with great courage, after 30 years, decided to go back to study. A woman after my own heart, because I'm also somebody who came to academe late, so I understand that it is a courageous step, definitely, without a doubt. She took a postgraduate diploma in translation studies, which she then followed with a master's in translation. And her thesis was published by Malta University Publishers as Translating Reality. That was in 2007. And this was certainly a success because not everyone gets asked to publish their master's thesis. And this was obviously considered a very good one. And I happen to know that you got a wonderful endorsement from Eugene Nider, who is considered an authority in the subject, when he wrote to you and said it was one of the best things that he'd ever read about translation. So I think, you know,
I nearly cried when I read that, actually.
I'm sure. As I said, I think you're going to have to frame that, definitely, without a doubt. But today we're not going to speak about your research. We're going to speak about your love of books. And when we discussed the content of this interview, you said you would like to talk about milestones in your journey in the land of books. So I think we're in for a sort of a bit of an eclectic and fascinating half hour of travel. So welcome, Rosemary.
Thank you, Tricia, for inviting me on the program. I have to tell you, actually, that my parents and siblings were in a great worry about me when I was little, because I just refused to learn how to read. And it wasn't until I was 7 years old that they finally persuaded me, because, you know, I was just interested in singing, dancing, swimming, whatever, you know. The idea of sitting down for more than 2 minutes and reading was, you know, absolutely, no, completely. So anyway, and as it happened, my elder sister went to training college to become a teacher. And she got some advice how to deal with me. And they told her, you should try some reverse psychology. And since I happened to like stories, you know, being told stories, what they did was they left some lovely looking books around and refused to read them to me or tell me the story. So they told me, you know, you can learn to read and you'll find out for yourself. So I did, finally, at 7 years of age. But then, you know, once I discovered books,
you started to devour everything.
I did, actually, and I went through our whole library. And by the time I was 10 years old, my favorite author was Jane Austen. So you can imagine how I crammed, you know, those 3 years, literally from nothing to Jane Austen. And I have to tell you that it's still imprinted on my mind. It was like a kind of epiphany, really, when I read, I think it was Emma, actually, that I read first. But I felt this is great literature. I really felt that, and you know, read the rest of the books, and I haven't changed my mind. So you know, Jane Austen still is very much relevant, as we can see, actually, even from the TV and film productions that are still being made.
Very popular,
about her books. So anyways, from Jane Austen, I think the next milestone was probably when I was 15. I had an English pen friend, and he sent me a copy of The Hobbit as a Christmas present. And again, that was something of, you know, a shock practically, because I liked fairy tales, obviously, and I'd never read something, you know, fantasy. Tolkien is considered as the master of modern fantasy. And the way he managed to intertwine epics, legends, myths, fairy tale, you know, there are echoes of the Iliad in it, Beowulf, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and, you know, so many things. And this was
a wonderful
introduction to fantasy.
It's become a cult book, really.
It has, Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, definitely.
Yes.
And even The Hobbit.
Yes, I think they're going to make a film of that as well, apparently. You know, we talked about as well earlier that there are quite a strong links, obviously, between literature and films and TV. I have to say, you know, The Lord of the Rings was a wonderful production, the film production, and certainly with modern spectacular effects, you know, what they can do is really marvelous. What just disappointed me in Jackson's film was that the trend nowadays is for very dark and gloomy outlook, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And when you actually read the books, they're a very nice balance or blend of happiness and sort of gloomy, evil, you know, threatening everywhere. So, for example, Rivendell is a very happy place, and it just doesn't sort of come out in the films. And the glory of Lothlorien, you know, it just remains something very cold, really, just cold magic, sort of. I was sorry about that, because, as I said, the books themselves, I think, are a far richer experience.
Do you go back to Tolkien now? I mean, you read it then, and
you go back and read it
again. Is it one of those books?
Yes, that's, you know, occasionally I go back and read. And as you were saying, yes, it's become quite a cult, and also there are so many books now about magic realism. It's a genre as well. And I'm happy to say that even in Malta we have the two authors, Simon Bartolon and Laurent Vella, who have brought out the trilogy, Ilfidin trilogy. So and apparently there's quite a good following for there as well. So I'm pleased to see that even in Malta we do have all these genres,
being
done
as well. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And besides fantasy, and obviously, as I said, I still like reading that as well, there's also science fiction, which I like. And they're interrelated, of course, because both fantasy and science fiction build an imaginary world, whereas fantasy deals more with possibly, you know, sword and sorcery or things that can't possibly exist. In science fiction, you get these possible worlds or cultures or civilizations based on either in our world in the future, or, you know, based on some scientific or technological discoveries. So
Arthur C. Clarke, I suppose, is a good example of that.
Yes.
He was a scientist.
Exactly.
And also wrote,
yes, exactly, and has got quite a cult following. And I remember reading Isaac Asimov, the iRobot series, which was very, very interesting. It was interesting to note, I just started to read Mario Azzopardi's latest collection of short stories, and in one of them he actually refers to Isaac Asimov, and in fact, you know, he's got a reference to somebody called, you know, based on his name, Isaac Asimov. In science fiction, besides, I wanted to tell you, for example, also the films that were made. What was so interesting is to see how things have actually come true. Like the communicator that was used in Star Trek is exactly like my mobile phone. You know, it's a flip phone. I think a lot of the science fiction used to deal with things of that could be possibly happen after nuclear holocaust and the Cold War. That was more late after 1960. And nowadays it's dealing more with after global warming, the dangers posed by nanotechnology and stuff like that. So obviously the themes move along. And
I'm still waiting for Beam Me Up, Scotty. I'm rather hoping that might become a reality in my lifetime, but I fear not.
Don't be disappointed. It's actually been managed, not with people, but with an object. It's been actually done by some Australian scientists, I believe, last year. So I think that was the name of the article, Beam Me Up, Scotty. I'm talking about the Cold War. One of my favorite things to read is spy stories as well. I've got a whole collection of John le Carré, for example, and whodunits. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't like to read whodunits?
I love your. You made a reference to Ellis Peters when we spoke about what we the content of this interview, and I love Ellis Peters.
Oh my goodness! That was quite a discovery. She really started off the trend or subgenre of placing a whodunit in some bygone age. Her brother Cat Fayel, in fact, was also made into a television series, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's one of my favorite subgenre, because I'm also very interested in civilizations and archaeology and anthropology. So it's wonderful when they are able to mix that sort of thing. And some of them are so very well researched. We mentioned Ellis Peters, you know, in medieval England, talking about, and there's, for example, Stephen Saylor, who puts his detective back in ancient Rome. If I just may, you know, being a literary translator, if I may, you know, point to a particular moment when I think I became interested in the resonance of particular words or expressions in any language. And in fact, this happened really when I was studying for my French A-level, and I was reading a critic of Racine, and he said that il font rire dans l'âme, which means he makes you laugh in your soul. But in this context, you know, arms, soul, it's not really just a soul. You can translate it as in the depths of your being, you know, and the core. So there are various ways of translating that. And it has so many connotations and so many associations that it's very difficult to translate in another word, which made me think, obviously, of the other thing. Like in Maltese, we have the word henda. You can't just translate it as serenity or peace or quiet or stillness. It's all those things together. So, and you know, this made me look at the language use in particular. So I think that was quite a significant moment for me as well.
What about the writers that you've mentioned are writers who are sort of Northern European or French, but what about the Mediterranean? Because you are very much a Mediterranean person, and you love, you know, your Maltese, obviously, and all the rest of it.
Yes, and in fact, as I was telling you earlier, I think one of the milestones in my life was when I read Camus. Because, and again, you know, when the first hour, it was like a shock, you know. I really identified with the Mediterranean identity that he was presenting. I'd never read before anything sort of that was so very clearly describing, you know, the scorching hot summers and the sea. It's not just a physical presence, you know, in the books. It's metaphysical, really, or symbolic. From Camus, it also made me think of and read again Francis Avier, whose plays, you know, certainly are, you know, is definitely considered great literature, as I said, especially his plays. And so that made me sort of think, go on another tack and try to read more about our own area, which can inspire readers and inspire readers. Talking about also Maltese literature, I have to say that in Oliver Frigeri's latest trilogy, actually his third novel hasn't been published yet, but I've read the manuscript. The central figure or the female protagonist, Susanna, reminded me very much of one of Flaubert's story. I know Flaubert usually is mentioned, or equivalent to his masterpiece, Madame Bovary. But in actual fact, my lasting impression of Flaubert is of his Trois Contes, where he deals with unimportant people, ordinary people, hardworking, ordinary, very much, unobserved usually, or not given any importance whatsoever, the salt of the earth when you refer to people like that. And his story of Virginie, has just literally haunted me through the years. Hardworking person, but nothing ever sort of went right for her. She never found real love and died a miserable death, and
it sounds like Flaubert.
yes, quite. But so instead of focusing on her heroes and heroines or important events, sometimes we do forget that there are ordinary people living ordinary lives, and the spotlight on them, I think, is again, it's the sort that people, should appreciate more perhaps. Talking about Oliver Frigeri, I have to say that it was such an honor when I was asked to translate his favorite, actually, Jezmin Le'at Ma'ifta, which is very highly autobiographical as well, and it really relates a passing way of life. And it also reminded me very much of Alphonse Daudet's Lettres de mon Moulin, Letters from My Windmill, where he writes about people and characters, a way of life in Provence, with a lot of tenderness and delicacy. And it's very interesting to note that in his preface, Frigeri wrote Bnejt kollox fuq l-aqda bejn il-memorja u l-immaginazzjoni. And Alphonse Daudet, in fact, said, for me, to invent is to remember. So here we are, very much the same sort of thing. If I can go on another tack completely.
Absolutely.
And come back and come more to the present day, I think one of the books that really again sort of shocked me into some sudden awareness or reality was Chimica by Emmanuel Mifsud. It deals with the sinister side of life, with drug addiction and prostitution and, a lot of criminal activity as well. And it really made me think, this is talking about Malta. Of course, it's fiction, but it's based on things that, do happen. And the thing is, usually, or you read about this sort of thing, but abroad. And, this really brought it not just closer to home, brought it home. And you think, my goodness, it's true, we're living in this tiny island, and it's like living in another world, totally. And also some books by, recently by Mario Tsopardi, again, deals with hard issues. And I'd just like to say that, in fact, it was Hans Robert Jaus, who one of the proponents of reception theory, who definitely insists that fiction, or rather literary works, have a socially formative function. And one of their functions is to bring about emancipation from natural, religious, and social conditioning. So definitely, literary works, that is definitely one of the functions that that they can provide.
Well, I think the other day I was interviewing a couple of students who were studying child law. And they were with me to talk about a seminar that they were organising. And this was one of the comments they made in their own context, that they were shocked when they looked into the fact that there was poverty in Malta. Physical poverty. Obviously, we don't think, as you were saying, we don't think of Malta as, like, poverty is in third world countries, not Malta. And of course, there can be poverty at various levels as well.
Yes, of course.
But they were very shocked by it.
Yes, it is. That's quite right. You know, literary work, you know, definitely bring this home to us. Though there could be new stories, of course, which focus on that. But somehow, you know, when you read a story, that's one of the functions of literature. It brings it all into focus. You can make the reader identify with you. So, and you end up, you know, really providing a very a very good arena for discussing social issues and stuff that, you know, society should be looking at and addressing. So, I mean, that's definitely one of the most important functions that literature has. What I'd like to say is that when you're reading something, it's definitely not simply escapism, and it's not a substitute for real living. And in fact, the more you've read, the more experience of life or of different things you have, the richer it can be your reading experience. And books themselves are not static objects. In fact, for example, Hans-Georg Gadamer, in modern hermeneutics, which is the theory and methodology of interpretation, he talks about a growth in meaning, and he compares reading to a game and its player. So every time it's being played, it's something different, or there's an enhancement. So, you know, so the being played, every time you learn new things or appreciate new things, you know, things that you just didn't notice before suddenly, you know, leap out at you. So it's a continual exchange between the reader, even if you've read the same book, you know, hundreds of times before, you see things again differently. So
one of the things that I noticed recently, as I browse around bookshops, is the amount of translation of books that, I don't know, The Famous Five, for example, has been translated into Maltese. And I see them disappearing off the shelf. So here there are two questions to ask, really. One is, are young people reading here in Malta, and are they reading in Maltese?
Well, perhaps I'm not the best person to ask, but definitely, I think there has been maybe a bit more effort and you know, directed actually at producing books that would appeal to Maltese readers, both in Maltese and in English, well, you know, I mean, or other languages. But even in Malta and Maltese books, we've come a long way. And there are some wonderful books around. And I know that, for example, from when my children, you know, were little, it was still quite difficult to find interesting looking books, and as they grew, you know, and even into teenagers. So, but nowadays there's a whole lot out there, and it's very encouraging. I know from my two daughters' contemporaries, well, at least their friends like to read. So, yes, I think there's hope, you know, and there are books. It's interesting when you also get translations of favorites into Maltese, and I think that's a very good sign as well.
You're working on your PhD now. I'm sure you're working very hard at it. What direction is it taking at the moment?
I need to get down more to it, actually. But Actually, trying to see the concept of perception. I'm investigating the concept of perception as a literary term, because very often it is used, and they go back to its idea in a philosophical or possibly psychological terms. But as a literary term, it's used very loosely. Part of my discussion is about that, how loosely it's been used as a literary term. And I'm trying to, what they call it, operationalize it. A definite sort of definition of it, breaking it up into components. And the springboard for it is obviously in literature. So I've identified some novels, and I'll be discussing those in more depth.
I suppose once you're doing your doctoral studies, there isn't much time to actually pick up a novel, but do you have one on your bedside table right now?
Well, actually, yes. Mario Zopardi gave me, not a novel, his latest collection of short stories, Schizzi al Carnaval. And he just gave it to me last week, and I've been meaning to get that. I've only managed so far to read the first two, but I intend to finish off with that.
Well, short stories is probably a good idea, because at least you can read a chunk and get somewhere.
And you know, when you go back to it, yeah, it's easier to remember. Oh yes, that's where I left off. So
exactly.
Definitely.
Well, thank you very, very much, Rosemary Caruana, for coming to talk to us about your literary journey through your life. It was absolutely fascinating. And thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tricia.
Thank you for listening to Talking Books. I hope you can join us next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.